Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Penny Eiler, a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a current member, a member of the wider community, or by our own minister, Reverend Sandra Ingram. This morning, our own John Richards will share his Antarctica experiences. And we suggest you come more than one Sunday to get a full flavor of what Prairie is, because it's something new every time. At this time, I'll ask Phyllis Long to come up and share the opening words.
Okay. This is from the Antarctic Treaty of December 1, 1959. Recognizing that it is in the interest of all mankind that Antarctica shall continue forever to be used exclusively for peaceful purposes and shall not become the scene or object of international discord. Acknowledging the substantial contributions to scientific knowledge resulting from internation cooperation and scientific investigation in Antarctica. Antarctica shall be used for peaceful purposes only. There shall be prohibited any measures of a military nature, such as the establishment of military bases and fortifications, the carrying out of military maneuvers, as well as the testing of any type of weapons.
This morning, we have the Global Chalice Lighting.
Life, unfathomable plenty. You carry us and imbue us and flow around us. You call us, like everything, into being and give everyone our time, that we may make use of it to come to know you, to encounter you in light and shadow. We take and accept you, and we are thankful. Find us prepared. It's by Hans Dietrich Kahl from the German Unitarian Religion Society or something like that.
This morning's services. Kind of a family affair. Our opening song was Gavin and Richards, and his father is going to share the presentation with us today. So, and John Richards is a computer systems administrator in charge of large data storage for the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center. Whew. Yes, and we're talking lots of storage. He just returned from the fourth trip to support the Ice Cube neutrino observation at the South Pole. And welcome, John.
Thank you for coming. This is what I do for work, and I have the joy of it actually being fairly fun too. I got my degree in computer science, so I get to treat the astrophysics part of this as a hobby, which makes it, I think, a whole lot more fun. I called in my summer vacation at the South Pole just to remind me to thank my wife, because the hardest thing about going there isn't for me, it's for her. She has to watch our kids. The minimum time you go is usually 2 weeks, and that means you're usually gone for four, because it takes a minimum of 72 hours to get there and 72 hours to come back. So, even though she's not here today, thank you for thinking of her. Oh, I forgot. Okay. Ice Cube Collaboration, which is the people responsible for this detector, are scattered all around the world. I'm lucky that the headquarters are here in Madison, because the University of Wisconsin-Madison is the host institution, which means we have the offices and the accounting folks and the data storage and some of the data analysis. The work, the analysis, the ideas for what we're doing come from all over. Remember if I had anything else. So I called it a neutrino observatory, but to understand what that is, first thing you need to know is what a neutrino is. It's a tiny subatomic particle. It was theorized back in around 1910 when all we knew about were protons, neutrons, and electrons, because they didn't tell the whole story. There was cases where if you were watching tiny interactions of subatomic particles, you'd see a proton and electron go shooting off after a neutron decays. And the neutron was just sitting here, stable, and the electron and proton went zooming off in one direction, and conservation of momentum says there had to be something going off that way that we didn't see, because the total momentum has to add up to the momentum of the original neutron, which was sitting still. But the problem with that is it had to have no charge, because the electron and proton have all the electric charge going off with them. And as far as we could tell at that time, the mass of the electron and the proton added up to the mass of the neutron. So whatever was going off that way had no charge and apparently had no mass. So the guy who proposed this wasn't sure that it existed, and his quote that I find fun is, "I've done a horrible thing. I have invented a particle that can never be detected." But the science worked, and as it turned out, neutrinos aren't totally non-interacting. They pass through matter normally without interacting at all, but if you get a low probability collision with the nucleus of another atom, you actually get results from that, and you can see that. So why do we care about them if they rarely interact? They travel in straight lines like light, but light gets absorbed by lots of things. Even if you look at the sun, the light you're getting from the sun is from the 50,000 degree surface of the sun. But what's happening on the inside of the sun is millions of degrees fusion processes. But you won't actually see them because the light and most of the energy being produced by that is being absorbed by the cooler outer layers. So neutrinos can tell us about what's going on inside the sun, for example. But why look other places if we can just prove they exist? Astronomy has always been kind of a pure science, a search for truth. And what we found is every time we look at the universe in a different way, we find out new things. These are three pictures of the Crab Nebula. In the one on the upper left-hand corner is visible light, so that's what we human beings could see if we had a really good telescope. Then the one in the upper right-hand corner is infrared, which actually has some details to it that aren't visible there. Then this one is X-rays, and I love the structure of this thing because it actually has some detail to it with this rotating and the jets going off either way that we'd never see with just visible light. Now the theory is, we can't take pictures of the Crab Nebula yet, but if we look at the universe in general with neutrinos, we expect to see something new. So how do you spot them? As I said, if there's a low probability, it'll run into the nucleus and it'll make a flash of light. Actually what it does is it produces a very short-lived thing called a muon. And a muon passing through ice emits Cherenkov radiation, a very faint blue light. Since it's so faint, what you need is something that has incredible low light sensitivity, and so you also need a really dark place, because like in here, you'll never see that interaction, even though it may be happening, because of the regular light passing through here. Also, since it's such low probability, you need a big detector. The first detectors were basically big tanks of water in mountains, and that was the way they proved that they existed. They started seeing flashes of light from nothing that couldn't have been anything but a neutrino. Nothing but a neutrino could have penetrated that far into a mountain. But you need a big tank of water to see an occasional flash. We're trying to see it fairly often, so we need a massive detector. The ice cube detector is named after the cube of ice that we installed our detector in, and it's basically a cubic kilometer. It's down a kilometer below the surface. That's where it starts. It goes down to 2 kilometers below the surface, and it's about a kilometer wide. Also, it takes patience. Even though we're looking for neutrinos, cosmic rays, a lot of nuclear reactions are happening in the atmosphere all the time, and they're creating particles passing through our detector, actually at a rate of about 10 billion to 1 for just random stuff versus neutrinos. So we have to sort through a lot of data, and that's where I come in. I store the stuff that people are looking through over the years. Okay, so yes, to detect it, we're using a big block of ice. It has to be dark, has to be deep. And what we also found out is that Antarctic ice is incredibly clear, which helps with the propagation of light. It means that if light is produced over here, we can detect it over here. This was unknown before we did this. The Antarctic ice is really uniquely clear. Light, we've managed to prove photons can travel unimpeded for 300 meters, when in filtered water in labs, the 10 meters is about the best you can hope for. This is, that's interesting. Let's see. Yeah, I know what that's supposed to be. That's supposed to be a picture of the, what that's supposed to be is a nice unimpeded view of the South Pole from up in the sky. This is the same thing with a little more detail. They're really at the South Pole, it's a big flat glacier, almost perfectly flat. When you're standing there, you don't see anything on the horizon. So over there, South Pole Station, that's where most people live and work. Then there's a runway in between here that's just made of snow. Then on the far side of the runway, there's what's called the dark sector, where people who are doing astronomy set up shop. And one of the things buildings out there is the Ice Cube Lab, which is basically our computer room where all the data ends up. Each one of these dots is an indicator. You can't actually see those when you're at the South Pole. It looks just white. But those are markings on where we've drilled one hole in the ice to drop down light detectors. So the actual array, this is an image, an idea of what the detector actually looks like. So we've got up at the top, let's see, we have a laser here, don't we? Yes. Okay, so up at the top, you've got the Ice Cube Lab, and then each one of these was a hole in the ice that we drilled and dropped in light detectors. So this is one of our light detectors. This is basically the opposite of a light bulb. Instead of you putting light energy in and getting light out, this one, if light comes in, produces a tiny amount of electricity that's then picked up by a computer up top here. And if it's an interesting enough event, which means that other light detectors say they saw something, it sends a signal up to the surface. So in each of these holes, we've got 60 of these spaced about 15 meters apart. 86 holes, that makes for like 5,160 of these things. Okay, so how do we make those holes? We have to make them quickly because as soon as you, we're trying to get this thing done in a reasonable amount of time. And summers in the at the South Pole is really the only time you can do major work because it gets too cold in wintertime. So we have between about beginning of November to beginning of February as our window to get work done. So to drill 86 holes in less than a century, we needed a way to drill multiple ones in a year. And the way that they did it, because it was proved with a predecessor called Amanda, was a hot water drill. We use a regular, just basically heavy weight to melt through the surface snow, which is about 100 feet or so. Then once you hit the solid ice, you drop down that thing, which is basically an incredibly heavy hose that pumps out hot water, melts a hole, and then recycles the water back up to the surface to recirculate. So one of our big footprint things that no longer exists is the drill camp, the facility that mainly heated up the water and was mainly made up of car wash heaters, of all things. Turns out they were durable, reliable, easy to service, low-tech, but who cares? It worked. Okay, so once we've got a hole, we start dropping one of these down. This is the cable that's actually supporting the whole thing and transmitting the data back up. So the cable's on a big spool, and as the cable goes by, it pauses to let us put on these optical modules, 60 of them, and then you drop them down into the ice. The biggest trick to this one is that the hole is going to start refreezing as soon as you stop drilling. When you bring the drill head up, it's mostly full of water. You can actually see the water. If that dom wasn't in the way, you might see some light reflecting off the surface about 100 feet down. So the hole starts to refreeze, and if it refreezes before you've got your things in place, you're stuck. There's no way to clear it once you've started putting a string in there. But the other trick is this is incredibly fuel consumptive. So the smaller you can make it, the more fuel efficient it is, the better it is for everybody. You have to get the stuff in there in 36 hours or it's not going in at all. And in fact, one of the problems that people have had multiple times is drill heads. In both the Amanda project and one more recent project, they tried going on a smaller scale, making smaller holes quickly. And what it turned out, we had the advantage of big heads tend to circulate a bigger area of water. Smaller heads actually had a problem with the hole refreezing behind the drill head. And once that happened, there was nothing you could do because you can no longer move the drill head. The only solution was to cut it off and come back another year because that sort of thing you can't really carry spares for. Okay, so we work at the South Pole, but we can't fly directly there. That airport's not set up for that sort of thing. So we actually come from New Zealand, which if you're coming from the United States seems kind of inefficient because you're traveling, it's about a 16-hour trip from Los Angeles to New Zealand. But it turns out if you draw a straight line between New Zealand and the South Pole, there's this nice station that's the oldest U.S. presence on it and Antarctica, which is called McMurdo Station. The reason McMurdo, and then for us who are going on to the South Pole, it's another 3 hours from with a different flight to get to the actual South Pole. So the flights from New Zealand are all military ones. There are New Zealand and Australia have both experimented with actually running commercial Airbus airplanes down here. And it works, but it's actually harder to maintain. So if you're lucky and you're going from New Zealand on a jet, it'll take you 5 hours to get to Antarctica. Otherwise, it's about eight. So this is McMurdo Station, not the prettiest place in the world. We freely admit that. But it is the one place where you can get, it is the one place you can get a container ship in. And that's huge, of course, if you're planning on shipping any quantity of stuff. One of these container ships carries about, it's actually for a shipping thing, relatively small. It's just under 1,000 shipping containers, whereas one of those Globemasters can carry about 10. So one of these can carry 100 flights worth of stuff in a lot more fuel-efficient manner. So it all gets unloaded here, and then if it has to go on, then it gets loaded onto airplanes from there. Antarctica is mostly a desert. You get snow occasionally. At the South Pole, when there's snow in the air, it's usually not fresh snow. What it usually is snow that's been picked up one place and brought somewhere else. Summertime is kind of nice. There's actually a great webcam. If you just search for McMurdo Station, you can see what the current weather is like. And yeah, it's getting gloomy, but partly because the sun's getting ready to go down. Okay, so This is just I found the visibility in Antarctica very interesting. This is actually mostly just fog. From McMurdo, you can see in the distance Castle Rock, and it's close enough that you can make a day hike to it. But that was about the limit of visibility. But then the next day, I was flying out of the airfield, and this down here is actually that rock we were just looking at, and I was viewing it from right here. So that was 3 miles of visibility. This is from 32 miles away, and I would estimate the visibility, if you weren't caring about details, you could see 80 miles fairly easily in most directions. Okay, so if you're moving on to the South Pole, this is your last chance to see wildlife. Everybody loves penguins. When I present to schools, I have to start with those, I'm afraid. When you talk about environment, Antarctica is an odd case because the visible environment is fairly limited. The things that live on land that aren't insects are basically water dependent. You'll see seals, you'll see penguins, and you'll see birds, but they all depend on the ocean. One thing that you don't get to see, this is actually basically right below those birds, that bird's feet. This is McMurdo Sound. Underneath the ice, there's a huge amount of life. It's not something that the first explorers would ever have known about. They don't go scuba diving, so. Okay, so this is how we get from McMurdo to the South Pole. Field in McMurdo is an ice sheet, which is about 10 feet thick. At the South Pole, it's all packed snow because the warmest it's ever gotten at the South Pole that we've recorded is 7 degrees Fahrenheit. So water never melts. So what we've got at the South Pole is 100 feet of packed snow, and it's not solid enough to land the bigger planes. So we fly on this one, and if you're a plane buff, these things are just... they're ugly, they're loud, but the things that they can do are really quite cool. They were first built in 1951, and they're still in production today in Georgia because proposed designs have come up, and they've all been quite expensive and too high-tech for jobs like this, where the objective is to keep it flying. So this is basically, there's a C-130 that travels all over. The only thing that makes this difference is the skis on the bottom. So this is the luxury travel. There's about 4 windows total in the passenger compartment because it's mainly a cargo plane. You sit on the sides, you face your bag sitting in the middle, and the back of the plane is usually full of everything else that's going to the South Pole with you. Okay, so this is what the airstrip at the South Pole is. And we've got a fuel station, but it's not refueling that plane. It's actually sucking fuel out of that plane because the main way that all the fuel gets down there is from the fuel tanks of these LC-130s. They come down totally full. They empty out about 2/3 of their tanks into these, and then they fly back on the remaining fuel. So I always thought that was kind of odd. People have suggested overland because, overland is more fuel efficient. And they have done it. The first year they ever managed to do a cargo-carrying traverse was in 2006. But it is a 1,000-mile trip each way, and you want to get it done in the summertime. You don't want bad weather to come in. And you're not dealing with roads. You're dealing with, first let me show you what the cargo looks like. These are basically sleds full of fuel. Those are basically huge water balloons with... fuel for the South Pole. And on this, the traverse that they've succeeded at, it's 110 tons of cargo, which replaces 11 plane flights for quite a bit less. But this is the sort of thing you have to deal with. This is just one of the crevasses that they discovered. This one has a 25-foot ice bridge, so it was thick enough for all that stuff to go across. But you can't see it. It's 86 feet deep and about 40 feet wide at its widest. And so basically, the first the first vehicle in the Traverse is always one that's got radar looking out in front of it to see whether or not small things with not a good land bridge are in front of you. So we mostly fly. The United States has had a presence at the South Pole since the 50s, and I think this thing has been there since the 50s, too. Actually, I looked at the bottom, the manufacture date is not before 1950. It was actually shipped to be used in the Korean War and not. It's still in use today. When the South Pole is busy, this is called summer camp because the overflow from the main station, you stay here. It's actually fairly comfortable because the main people who have stayed in these over the years is construction people. And so when you go in, there's a whole lot of patchwork insulation. The wall in my room was made out of unfolded olive oil cans that someone had recycled. And yeah, it was quite comfy. Though I did find out my bag was in a strategic spot. I had to send it out a day ahead of me because it had to go by cargo. And that night was the coldest night, and it turned out it was sitting in front of a breeze that was coming in the side of. I was always wondering why I had to unfold my jeans when they. So the first step up in housing was the dome, finished in 1973, and it was in use till 2010, though in its later parts of life it was mainly a big freezer. So you'd go in there and you'd see pallets of flour, that sort of thing. At that point, it wasn't heated anymore. In 2003, this was made habitable. Construction continued for quite a bit, but this is the new South Pole station. It's an elevated station. It's a little hard to see here because we're on the uphill side, but the front of this, front being towards the prevailing winds, is angled kind of like a inverted airplane wing to try to speed up the air to scour below it, because anytime you put a vertical surface at the South Pole, it immediately starts to get covered just by drifting snow. because even though the snow is not falling, it's blowing from side to side. So actually the dome, when it was decommissioned, was almost entirely covered with snow. This is a lot more comfortable. It's very nice. It wasn't built with the idea of keeping it snow-free because we hadn't been there long enough. Everything up to the dome had pretty much been temporary, mainly containers. So every year you could just dig it out and move it, but the dome you couldn't. So yeah, it, as soon as it was built, snow started building up on the outside. So this is houses about 150 people, though only about 45 stay there year-round. It's got a cafeteria, a gym, generators. It's a nice, comfortable 68 degrees in there. And it also contains science offices. So if we're doing our job right, we have two people who stay in the station year-round through the long, dark winter. And if we've set up things right, they can do all the stuff they need to do from in that station. This is just what a interior room on the station. It's basically as small as possible, but still, I'm not going to complain. It's quite cozy. Quick shot of the galley. Oh, I forgot to mention the greenhouse. It's not enough to like really sustain people, but greenery when you don't have it is so valuable. So it's hydroponic, and they usually wipe it clear of all plants start fresh, and within about 3 weeks they're getting lettuce, and within 6 weeks they've got tiny little zucchini tomatoes, that sort of thing. Okay, so this is our crew standing at the South Pole, though someone's absconded with the real South Pole and replaced it with one of our optical modules. This is the one that you take pictures by. It's got all the flags, it's got the red stripes on it. But there's also the geographic South Pole, and that one isn't as fancy because it moves 30 feet, 10 meters every year. Actually, it doesn't move. We move. The whole station is sliding off towards the sea, and in about 50,000 years, it'll get there. This is 2011, when I went back this year, the station, you're already about 100 feet off to your left. This is what the inside of our server room looks like. Each one of those red wires comes from four, carries the data for four of one of these optical modules, so I don't really remember how many cables that makes it, but it's a lot. The main type of computer in there is for the reading the data out of those optical modules. We also do a lot of data processing down there. So this is our workroom, which is a little bit a quieter space to work in, though actually if you look at the back wall, that's ventilation, which means you're just part of the circulating system of the air in here. The return air is passing through this room. We actually don't heat this because our computers, we use up about 60 kilowatts of power. And so our main job is cooling this down. So the main air handling in this is mixing outside air with our already heated air and trying to make it to a livable temperature. In fact, we've had problems where it's gotten too hot. When an emergency happens, fire alarm goes off, the system shuts down and our server room reaches about 100 degrees in 20 minutes. Okay, and this is our fancy facilities. There's no running water anywhere but the station. So, that's. You have to go outdoors. It's done by construction engineers, so it's as comfy as possible. It's black to absorb what sunlight there is. The seat is made from basically non-reactive insulation. So basically, it heats up as soon as you sit down. But you still have a kind of a breeze. You don't want to stay in there too long. In wintertime, they don't have a toilet out there. They're basically running back to the station or carrying something back with them. Yeah, because the station has generators and they have what's called a rod well system, where they basically drop what is like our hot water drill, except they just drop it down far enough into the ice to start making a hole, and they just keep circulating warm water through it. And they melt about a 100 foot wide by 300 foot deep reservoir of water. And then they use that to supply the station. It's actually so clean that they have to add minerals to it to keep it from leaching minerals out of your body. It's unhealthy to drink, but it is, it's just incredibly clean. Somebody called it Jesus water just because you're melting from the layer that was put down about 2,000 years ago. Once they've emptied out one, they start using the old one as a reservoir. So very much so. You don't want to mix the two up. So that's kind of what it's like at the South Pole. I've got more pictures, but my main purpose was to open up for questions. If anybody wants to see a couple quick pictures by some of our winter overs what the South Pole looks like in wintertime. The Aurora Australis, this is our lab. That's the moon in a time lapse exposure, and that's the two little lights that you'd be walking towards if you're going out there in wintertime. And actually, even though we do the best we can, computers still crash, and they still do make that trip. And actually, at that point, it's foot only. You're getting down to near 100 below, and none of the machinery will keep running in that temperature. You might get it started, but it's not going to survive. So it's cross-country skis. Our current winter over brought a wide-tire bicycle. Our distance here, this is about 1 kilometer for us. Let me just quickly scan through a couple more slides. This is if you want a real outdoors experience, that's a tent you can camp in. That's a shot of midwinter where frost is forming on everything. When I first got there, the outside of this station was actually plywood, and it stayed that way for about 4 years because there's no deterioration. There's no liquid water hitting it. It was just one of the last, the outside there is kind of for prettiness sake. The plywood would have lasted quite a long time as well. Another shot of Aurora. Oh, okay, and then boring details. Yeah, that was basically for, so I can remember some of my numbers. Well, and actually, music? If you are an artist, there is an artist in residence grant that basically every year they send down somebody who's an artist of some kind, literature, painting, sculpture. But I certainly haven't delved into it. There, yes, it exists, and I'm not literary enough to really know much about it. No, that, okay, 300 Degree Club, you'd have to be a winner over, because the 300 Degree Club depends on a minus 100 degree temperature outside. And what you do is you go in the sauna, you get the temperature up to 200 degrees, then you run outside and get your picture taken by the ceremonial South Pole. And most of those aren't fit for sharing, because usually there's no clothes involved. But yeah, actually, people get disappointed. There are years where it never gets to minus 100, and people are like, I missed my chance to join. I feel like I'm boring people when I hit people with stuff like that, but that's my main focus, so I'd love to tell you. We get a huge amount of data. We throw away probably 99% of it, 99% of the events at the first pass, basically by, it arrives up and there it gets decided that, well, only five or six optical modules saw this event, so we'll never be able to really recreate much about it, so we're gonna throw it away. The interesting stuff is about a terabyte a day. That gets saved mostly to tape, because we do have satellite connectivity, but most satellite connectivity is by geosynchronous orbit, by satellites over the equator, and those aren't visible to us. So our major satellites that we use are the old ones that have started to drift, because when they drift, they actually come above the horizon long enough for us to use them for a couple of hours before they drop back down. We get an allocation of about 100 gigabytes a day over that, and so we try to make sure that that's the most interesting stuff, because we have to wait till the end of the year for the tapes to come back. People like me have to go down, pack them up, and ship them. And then somebody has to read them out, and that's a whole other story. There was a predecessor to this called Amanda, that the same, Francis Halzen, who's our principal investigator, was one of the principal investigators for that. That started in around 1994, and they were using smaller modules. They were using 8-inch tubes instead of 10-inch, and they didn't go. They only put in 18 holes. It was really a test bed for, does this idea work? And that actually kept in operation until, let's see, probably 2007. We were using it, we actually built this detector around it, because we were using the data from it in addition to ours. So our first hole in the ice was, let's see, 2005. And actually, the way the detector works, you start getting data as soon as that string is done. So there was somebody who wrote a paper on the data from that single string. They actually managed to prove that there's a low probability of neutrinos coming up all the way along that string, and they found two of them over the whole year, and that's worth a paper. But so as they added more strings, it became more complete, and so the data becomes more interesting for people who are because you get more of a coverage. But yeah, it was in operation as soon as that one was signed off, and as soon as it had refrozen. Actually, that's one of the this thing is basically a bathysphere. It's made for deep ocean, because we're dropping it into water. But the other thing it has to survive is the refreezing of the ice, because ice expands, and so what ends up happening as the hole refreezes is it squeezes. And I forget what somebody said, 5,000 psi, something like that. But actually, we've had the design of this has been remarkably good. Our failure rate on those has mainly been actually from connectors. We lost a couple because the connector from this to the string broke, mainly because when you're connecting it, it's cold weather and it tends to crack. The one fun thing about that, though, is a lot of the ones we lost because it shorted out because water seeped in came back once the hole totally refroze, because it no longer shorted out when there was nothing but frost and ice. Well, so there's two questions there. We've got the Ice Cube project, which is projected to collect data for the next 20 years. And we're lucky in that we don't go all the way to bedrock. If we did, we'd start having problems with shear because the bottom layer is kind of getting held onto by the rock. And so you end up with bending and pulling and bad stuff like that. But turns out where we are, we won't see it in the next 20 years. Our block is going to stay a nice a block of ice. And the South Pole is convenient for some of our calculations, but it's not strictly necessary. So the position of our building, it would be fine elsewhere. We mainly picked the South Pole because there is already support there. It's got support for a dark scientific, well, telescope is kind of what some people call it. The station itself, that's going to be, it's going to slowly get further and further away from the geographic South Pole. I don't know what their projections are. I'm guessing that the current station, one of the ideas was they can relift it. Yeah, it's not a simple task, and they'd also have to relocate a bunch of people. So they'd probably need to be building, have a temporary housing or a second building while they were doing that. But I don't know the plans exactly. For most things people do down there, close proximity to the South Pole is not strictly necessary, so we may drift a little bit further away before anything new gets built. I was looking through presentations from just 2 years ago. We didn't have those named neutrinos yet. Before I hit you with their names, I'm going to hit you with a bit of the science. So people originally thought upgoing stuff passing through our detector was the only interesting stuff. Because what they're doing is using the Earth's surface or the Earth's matter as a filter. Because the only thing that could be coming up through our detector is a neutrino. And actually, at that point, they calculated my storage needs at 60 terabytes total for the whole project, which is, 15 hard drives these days? Our storage is currently at 4,000 terabytes and growing about 1,000 every year. What that extra data, though, it's found one of their big discoveries, which is it's big enough that you actually can look for stuff that's starting within the detector. When we first designed it, we figured that sort of thing might happen once or twice a year where we'd have a neutrino that actually came from above or some other direction and not start its collision until it was inside our detector. But when people started looking at the data, they actually found, first two, Ernie and Bert. they found two events that actually, they're huge for a couple of reasons. One, because they exist. We only thought that this would be, they're also a huge amount of energy. They're about 1,000 times as powerful as what Fermilab can present. Oh, actually, I think that I'm telling you the wrong one. 1,000 is about our average one. These are well above average. 1,000 times the power that Fermilab could generate. But they're entirely contained within the detector, which allowed them to calculate how much energy they were carrying. And that was kind of exciting because there's no way they could have been produced within our solar system. The kind of reactions that happen within our sun can't generate neutrinos of this energy. And so they're cosmic. So after they found Bert and Ernie, they found one huge one they called Big Bird. again, a paper was just written about just the energy contained in that one because it was the most energetic. But then, the total is up to 28 of these high energy neutrinos that have been captured within the detector, and they're all Muppets. I can't name them all, but yes, right. It's the amount of energy, and one of the holy grails of this originally, when we were just looking at upgoing neutrinos, was we wanted to see them coming from some spot in the sky. So what the upgoing neutrinos are doing is slowly mapping out dots on a map. And what we're hoping is over the lifetime of the detector, we'll start spotting spots in the sky that are generating unusual numbers. This one's been fun because there's definitely 7 out of the 28 that are coming from a fairly small circle that's towards the galactic center of the Milky Way galaxy. We don't know what produces them, but that's what this is all about. It's finding something new.
We don't have closing words today, but if you'll join me in extinguishing the chalice.
We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together. Thank you for coming. Greet your neighbor and stay for the auction.